She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And trust me when I say we're going to give you a lot to think about today. So press pause with your busy lives and take a minute, an hour, 60 minutes to really sit down and hear about and hopefully absorb a lot of the content for our show today. Before we get on with the show, I want to do a shout out to how this show is made possible. And it's due to the generous support of our sponsors. In this particular case, it's the Fairfax Companies, and they are true leaders in the business of sustainability. Since 1989, Fairfax has strived to be a leader in sustainability, and they're dedicated to improving the environment through creative and innovative management practices. And I hope that never sounds like a soundbite on my part, because they are improving the environment, which in turn improves the quality of life for all of us. Please visit them at thefairfaxcompanies.com. Okay, take a deep breath. The name of our show today is Change the Story, Change the Future. Please join me in welcoming our guest for this next hour. His name is David Corton. He is an American author, a lecturer, an engaged citizen, a former professor of the Harvard Business School. He's a political activist, prominent critic of corporate globalization, and by training and inclination, a student of psychology and behavioral systems. He is the author of 6 books, which is so daunting to me, having written one little book, including When Corporations Rule the World, and most recently, Change the Story, Change the Future, A Living Economy for a Living Earth. Welcome, David. It's such an honor to have you with us today.
Excellent. I'm honored to be on your show, and I'm looking forward to this very much.
You know, I have lots of specific questions about the book, because there's so much we could talk about in terms of your leadership, but it's a good way to start, and I want to put you on the spot right away and say, can we have this be Change the Story, Change the Future, Part 1, and maybe get you in our schedule for coming back so I can get to my third page of questions?
Sure. Well,
really,
I'd be happy to come back anytime.
Put him on the spot right there on the air. You heard him. So I chose to talk about Change the Future, Change the Story, Change the Future, because to me it's kind of like the quintessence of what your message is. So give us an overview of the book, and then we'll get into some of the really detailed questions I have to ask you about the important contents and the message.
Okay, the basic underlying story is that by nature, we humans live by our stories. And it's interesting, the reality that we live in is so complex. And as you really get into it, the forefronts of science and so forth, it is so complex that I basically believe it is way beyond current human understanding. So we've, from the beginning of our human awakening, have organized around stories that simplify the reality but give us a framework for living. And this is the way cultures organize around shared stories. Now, the problem that we're in right now is that we live with a cultural story that I call the sacred money and market story. And by the terms of that story, money is wealth. Making money creates wealth. The purpose of the economy is to make wealth. And the rich are the wealth creators. They're the ones that invest and they create wealth and they create jobs. So we should be thankful to them and give them all sorts of advantages.
Right.
And the corporations are engines of wealth creation. And so we have to recognize corporate rights and globalize the economy and take the restraints off of the market so that they can work at their full capacity. Now, every element of that basic story is false. That of course, money is in fact nothing but a number.
Right.
It's an accounting entry. It has no existence outside of the human mind, no reality. The real wealth is living wealth. The real story is that we humans are living beings. We are born of and nurtured by a living earth that is itself born of a living universe. And once we get into that story, which in fact is the most ancient of human stories, it gives us a totally different framework for thinking about the economy and the purpose of the economy, which is, I mean, the real purpose of the economy and of any human institution is properly to serve life and the community of life. And based on a recognition, and this is just, you know, just really kind of beginning to come into the frame of science, that life as we know it basically lives only in community, exists only in community, because the community has to self-organize, as we see Earth self-organize, to create the conditions essential to life. And so we humans have been organizing basically against life in order to make more money, and that is driving both social and environmental collapse. And that in turn gives birth to all the tremendous issues that we face in our world relating to environmental breakdown, the grotesque and growing inequality, and the corruption of our democracy, and virtually every other problem that our progressive movements organize around.
And, you know, I just want to ask you in terms of, we talk about, you talk about in the book something that rings true to me. There is a robotic state that I think all of us have in us to some degree. We have our story, and we're not conscious of the story. We live the story because it's so deeply embedded in us. But corporate robots and their minions, which, you know, I want to be a change the story, change the future minion, they want us to believe things about money and shopping. What do they want us to believe? That it makes us happy? And is it an intentional, oh, let's get them to believe this? Or do they believe it? I mean, that's three questions, but I know you get it. What do they want us to believe about things like money and shopping and the joy that that will bring us?
Well, I think they want us to believe exactly what you suggested, that the consumption is our key to happiness, and that the more we consume, the happier we'll be, and particularly you will be happy if you buy my product, because that will really give you a deep satisfaction.
That's really going to get you. Just watch the commercials.
Yeah.
It's like you want to be happy, and a lot of it involves taking this drug, unfortunately. Take
yes,
a pill,
exactly.
And you'll be happy. And then we'll give you a pill to fix whatever we broke by giving you that first pill. So it's, yeah.
Yes.
I love that conundrum.
But
yeah.
If that doesn't work, take double the dose.
Right, exactly. And you'll sleep so much better. So how do you tie it, and you do so artfully, wonderfully tie it, to the sacred money and market economy? It's impacting Earth, Mother Earth's capacity to fully support human life. Why is that? It's... You know, tell us about how you have tied this to why this is such a sustainability issue in its ultimate form, as in sustaining life.
Well, this of course begins to get us into some of our deeper stories. I mean, even though those of us who get a good education, our education in science tends to be built around the story that, you know, what I call the grand machine story, that the only reality is material, and that the explanation for our being and for the whole of creation is simply like the mechanisms of a great machine working out, and that most everything can be explained in terms of material mechanism or chance. And if you look deeper, that's actually it's a story of science, and it's the thing that fascinates me is science is dedicated to searching for truth, but it is also caught in its own cultural story, and that that mechanistic story is its story, which if you truly believe that, it becomes impossible to accept the idea that Earth itself is a living superorganism.
Right.
That essentially it is organizing with all of the living beings on Earth, working in conjunction with Earth's physical processes, which, you know, the analogy to our bodies is it's kind of the, you know, the skeletal structure on,
right.
On which the cell, around which the other cells organize. But if you cannot accept that life and the kind of the deeper spiritual frame that underlies that, then life itself has no meaning. We exist purely as a matter of chance and a chance outplay of physical mechanisms, which means there's no meaning or purpose. Now, if you really internalize that, wow. I mean, that is truly depressing.
It really, yes.
You know, I'm here alone, and this it all kind of appears to be a hell, and I'm stranded in this this death place.
Let me out of here.
Yeah. So, you know, it's easy then to buy into. Well, you know, buy my product and keep yourself distracted,
yes.
And
you'll be happy.
Work and sell your soul to do that.
Right.
Whereas if you recognize that the whole, you know, the whole of creation is really more like a living organism bursting forth, or a seed bursting forth into a flowering tree, and that the whole of creation is, you know, as science describes it, it has been from the beginning unfolding toward ever greater complexity, beauty, awareness, and possibility. And the fascinating thing that is the story that science really tells, but it's only beginning. I mean, more and more scientists are, I think, beginning to move beyond the traditional kind of Newtonian story, because the quantum physics and our deeper understanding of the unfolding of the cosmos goes so far beyond that story and mechanistic explanations, and that, of course, is one of our sources of hope for the future. But if we can embrace that unfolding, and then you realize that, you know, creation was not this also was not created for us, as
right.
some of the traditional religious stories would suggest, but we, as are all other aspects of creation, participants and contributors to this unfolding creative process toward increasing complexity, beauty, awareness, and possibility. And we humans, of course, have a distinctive, at least within our understanding, capacity for awareness, and with that capacity, an ability to effectively choose our own future. And we start choosing that future by our choice of the story around which we organize as a species. So as we begin to awaken to and organize around a life and living universe story, then everything begins to shift. And we suddenly realize, well, no, instead of working in opposition to the natural forces, the living Earth community, and the processes by which it is continuously regenerating our soils, our air, maintaining the stability of our climate, cleansing our waters and so forth, maintaining the conditions on this planet that, so far as we are yet aware, are wholly unlike anything on any other planet we have yet been able to identify. You know, we have an extraordinary place in this grand cosmic unfolding, which we're now understanding from science also, involves literally trillions of galaxies and stars, just absolutely beyond the imagination of future generation, previous generations of humans. So that fundamentally turns everything on its head in terms of thinking about the economy. And recognizing that we need to learn how life organizes and learn to organize in a similar way. Now, here's what's fascinating about that to me. Living systems, the decision-making is always local. It is actually individual cells, individual organisms, all acting individually, but in a way that plays out within the larger community, in a way that maintains the conditions necessary for all life. And, you know, we're encouraged to think about that process in terms of conventional science, in terms of competition and survival of the most violent. Of course, Darwin's actual thing was survival of the most fit, which in many respects means the species that fit best with their place and
right.
their environment.
Such a subtle but such an important nuance. I mean, that's
yes, exactly.
it's so important for people to just like, do you understand? It's not the person with the biggest stick wins. You so articulate that survival of the fittest in concert with nature.
Yeah. Now we can look into this and see it in terms of the ecosystem and the Earth's biosphere. But it becomes most clear when we think about our own bodies, and what we've been learning about our own bodies, each comprised of trillions of individual decision-making cells. And those are just the cells that are integral to our body structure. But the whole enterprise, our life, our the ability of those cells to function depends on trillions of additional organisms, microorganisms, which live within our bodies and on our skin, and which perform functions that are essential to our overall health and well-being.
Right.
And even here, in many of our medical procedures, you know, like antibiotics. I mean, we do have harmful organisms in our bodies that we do have to get rid of, but our body generally organizes to get rid of them, and most of our antibiotics do not discriminate between the ones that are essential to our health and the ones that are dangerous.
Right, they're just killing it all. Go in and blanket
exactly.
it all and see what happens, and may the strong survive. It's a great approach to medicine and healing.
But if you get into particularly the cells that are integral to our body structure,
right,
you realize, you know, decision-making cells, and, you know, I have no idea how it actually works, and I don't believe science does either. But it is as if each of those cells has an awareness of the importance of its own individuality, because each individual cell is important to the function of the whole, and it has its own distinctive function within the whole. But in performing that function, it is as if it is also aware that it is part of a larger community that must work together to maintain the conditions essential to the health of all of them. So that's where, to me, we see the most extraordinary expression of this dynamic of community, and that basically we're, you know, as a species now, we're making a transition from isolated local communities, and of course the most ancient traditional communities live very close to their place on Earth.
Right.
The tribes, the individuals, function very much as the member of the tribe. And the individual, their identity was inseparable from that of the tribe. And they, of course, each depended on each other. Now, basically, we are in a situation where we've got to learn to live as a global species, not just local, but we still are local everywhere in terms of our need to organize working with Earth systems. So our farming techniques are maintaining the fertility and regenerating the fertility of the soils. The move to living as nature does on current inflows of solar energy.
Right.
Is ultimately our primary exclusive source of energy. Maintaining the water cycles, continuously recycling the nutrients into the soil rather than a one-way flow of chemicals from sequestered in Earth and then ultimately polluting our water supplies and so forth and killing off the living beings in the ocean. Anyhow, it's an extraordinarily complex system. Now, what I love about this is, in terms of a market economy, if you really go back and look at the foundations of market theory, it started with Adam Smith. And if you actually read Adam Smith, his ideal was an economy based on single-person firms.
Okay, that's breaking it down.
The local farmer, the local artisan.
Yes.
And they're all organizing. You've got to take not only his Wealth of Nations book, but his other book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, in which he makes it very clear that he's assuming these businesses are organizing with a framework of community values and the natural tendency of a healthy human being to care about the well-being of his or her neighbors. And so that begins to give you a totally different frame on the market. And of course, our current, what we call a market economy, is not a market economy at all. It's a monopoly, an oligopoly system, or oligopoly, in which we have these just unbelievable concentrations, global concentrations of corporate power, that are wholly disconnected from concerns about life or concerns about any community. And you refer to the robotic part that, if you understand the system, and, when I was teaching at the Harvard Business School and my studies at Stanford Business School, it was all about organizational systems, how systems organize. And if you understand the corporation as an organizing system, it is actually designed to function as a money-seeking robot. Totally oblivious to any sort of human or natural values. It values life only for its market price and its value as an exploited resource.
I just have to throw this, and yet, when you're talking about that and how it is basically a contrived system, it's based on money, which is made up. You think about how people are addicted to how did the market do today?
When it
doesn't. No, what did the market do? Oh my gosh, the market's down. Oh my gosh, the market's up. Which really is an addiction to irrelevant, not really the pulse of America news. And that's, I want to ask you this question. And just bear with me, because there is a question here that's so relevant to what your book is about. And I use a quote, "Most efforts to avoid further collapse focus on treating the symptoms of a system failure with marginal adjustments." And when I was watching some of the news on Flint, Michigan, and their water, I want to use the word sad and depressing and egregious and outrageous to me on so many levels. I mean, the lying is one thing, but the health implications for all of the people that drank that water that might not show up for 5 or 10 years, every level. So this is what I think. What they're doing is changing out the pipes on and on and on. But they're looking at, it's a false system. They should be looking at why is there so much lead in the water in the first place? It's not just about changing out the pipes. You know what I mean? It's a much,
yes.
And when I was, I thought this has changed the story, changed the future. So even they're trying to do the right thing now, is it based on, you know, we have so many stories that are based on a self-destructive or a false system.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, that's brilliant. It's so right. And we get into these things, they're so immediate. You got to do something about the fact they're poisoning these people. So you need to put in this other chemical to stop the corrosion of the lead. But
one pill makes you larger. One pill
makes
you small.
But if we had been living properly, we would never have polluted the river in the first place.
Yes, our rivers never poisoned us. That's changing the story. Our rivers never poisoned us. How can we get to that's the emerging story? We have clean rivers is what we want to get to.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you also have to wonder, how did the lead get in the pipe in the first place? Because this is not a particularly new insight that lead is poisonous.
To our bodies. So there you have that. But I'm sure it was cheaper and easier, and it was part of the sacred market and money. Let's do this thing. It goes on and on and on.
But of course, another thing on the lead is, I saw a piece recently which was discussing the experience that we had within our lifetimes of the lead in gasoline and the extraordinary health implications that was having.
Right.
Of course, we were being fed a false story that it was all inconsequential and it didn't have any problem, and you had these paid consultants posing as scientific authorities spewing out the false story that it was all safe. And now, of course, we finally come to recognize it was not safe at all.
Right. And cigarettes don't cause cancer either, so I hope you never believe that they did. I mean, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Tobacco is not harmful to your health. And how long did they hold, you know, that's my story and I'm sticking to it. And that's one example of where we can have some hope.
Yeah.
Where do you stand on, and this is a question I usually leave to the end, but with my questions for you, there is no end. So just, you know, keep listening. It feels to me like the institutional structures in some ways have never been stronger. That's part of my belief. And then I live in a world of people that are, you know, excited about the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies and Local First, and of course all the people I interview. So I go from being frightened that the stories are so grounded and they're stronger to living in a moment of hope and opportunity. Is the sacred money or market story losing its power, or is it gaining? Is it eroding? Where do you think we sit now, right now, while we're doing this interview?
Well, we're in the midst of competing forces. And of course, the
great
sacred
answer.
Money and market story is a fabricated story.
Right.
And it is promoted very, very intentionally. It is supported by an economics discipline that is totally corrupt, morally and intellectually, that, you know, teaches us that this sacred money and market story is science, which it is the farthest thing from science. We have a legal system that, by its design, it actually gives corporations more rights than living people, and it gives nature virtually no rights at all. So there's an awful lot standing against us. At the same time, there is an extraordinary awakening that's taking place. And, you know, it's always hard to accurately assess these things, but my personal sense is that just within the last 6 months, we have been seeing almost a kind of explosive breakthrough in awareness of the deceptions of
right.
that story. And of course, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies and the Local First Movements and so forth are among the expressions of that. But also we have things like the Pope's encyclical.
Yes.
And, you know, his,
yes,
the homily that I just love, where he talks about the idolatry of money, literally the worship of money, you know, which begins to expose the fact that that the economics discipline as in the mainstream is more religion than a science. I think that actually does a disservice to religion, but the idea is it's a belief system. You know, the capitalist economics that we live with is an ideology. It has no grounding in reality, except that, you know, a real market, you know, organized within a frame of community values would be a very very positive thing, as long as we recognize that the market can't organize everything, but there are certain things like, you know, the farmer's market that...
Right.
market organizes very nicely.
Exactly. They show up every week, and you can count on them, and it's like, and it feeds our food and our soul. It's a perfect analogy, because an example, because that's about community. Everybody that goes to, yeah, the farmer's market, it's a whole different experience than pushing your cart quickly through Safeway, or any grocery store for that matter. It's,
yeah,
it's interaction, looking people in the eyes, talking with them, getting answers to your question. It's, and I'm sure that you're experiencing it everywhere you go. The local markets, I'd say 5 years ago we had 2 in Tucson. Now we have 15. The same thing up in Phoenix. They're in every community, and they're, you know, during days of the week, not just on Sundays. And so the proliferation of farmers market, that's one of the ones that does give me hope. It's so tangible, and it is about changing the way that we show up in the world.
Yes. Well, it's also, you know, one of the things that I see really coming together in a powerful way is the, you know, the local farming movement.
Yes.
So it's agriculture, but recognizing that the importance of the difference between healthy food and junk food, and the importance of organics, not, you know... We got a choice between toxic food and organic food.
One that'll kill us, one that'll nurture us. I mean, is not a hyperbole at all. I mean, our food is killing us.
Exactly. And what's happening in health? You know, I've myself started seeing a naturopath physician. Which gets one into understanding how our body heals itself, and all the processes of cleansing ourselves and opening them up so that they can actually perform their functions, maintaining the body that they're supposed to do, and how that relates to diet and self-regulation. And you begin to recognize within that frame the extent to which conventional medicine is basically limited to pills and surgery.
You couldn't pick a better story, as far as I'm concerned. And it's what's wrong. I'm seeing a naturopath as well. And the other day I went out to dinner with her, because we certainly have a lot in common to talk about in terms of the planet. And I said to her, Judy, I need to get a Western medical doctor, and I don't have one. And she started laughing, and she said, you know what she said, David, it made me so sad. She said, you do have to get a Western medical doctor, because my doctor retired, you know, about a year and a half ago, and I don't have anything wrong with me. So she said, because if something happens, even an, yeah, accident, I cannot admit you to the hospital. And I was like,
ooh,
wow. Talk about something else really brokey that's really wrong.
Yeah.
It's like, so I have to figure out. I mean, I'm going to have to do that, because, you know, that wouldn't be good if something
oh, yeah,
really happened. But that's a perfect example. And, of course, no medical plan covers naturopaths. So there you go.
Because
it,
yeah,
doesn't impact earnings per share. But it would. It so would. That's the false story I told myself. Yes, if they had naturopaths, the world would be healthier, and It would be real earnings per share because we'd be healthy. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this, because it's a perfect segue.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'm getting the sign that we're going to have a break. So I'm going to ask the question, and then we'll come back to it. But there is a dangerous premise. Many of the sacred money and market story, and I take a quote from the book, it's the conceit that with enough money, our human technologies will liberate us from a dependence on nature. And the way that I see that, and you know, therefore we do not see to her care. And I think about, we don't have to worry about running out of any fuels, because we'll invent a new technology. We'll have an answer for that. And you don't have to worry about this disease, because by the time, you know, blah, 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 we'll have a pill for that. So it is really ignoring the care from nature. And I'd love for you to expand on that now and after the break.
Yeah, well, this is...
It's a biggie.
Part of the distinction between, you know, do we look at the at Earth as a dead rock that we just happen to get stranded
yes.
on, or do we look at it as a living superorganism?
That gives us life.
It gives us life.
It gives us
life.
Literally
our Earth mother.
Yes.
And if you get into that frame, you recognize that there is absolutely no technology that can do what Earth does in terms of maintaining the health of our soils, our water, the stability of our climatic systems.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back, and we are going to talk about really considering nature when we're solving all these problems. David Korten, please stay here with me.
Mrs. Green's World's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for being with us. Just another quick shout out to the Fairfax companies for helping make this show possible. To find out more about them and their role as leaders in sustainability, please visit them at thefairfaxcompanies.com. The name of our show today is Change the Story, Change the Future. Please join me once again in welcoming our guest, David Korten, who is the author of a book by that name. And just a little bit more about David, he is the chair and co-founder of Yes Magazine. Check it out, yesmagazine.com. He is also the president and founder. Is it .org?
magazine.org.
Okay. As soon as I said that, I thought it's probably .org. He is also the president and founder of the Living Economies Forum, a board member of the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, co-chair of the New Economy Working Group, and a member of the Club of Rome. He holds MBA and PhD degrees from Stanford Graduate School of Business. And as I shared earlier, he's a former faculty member of the Harvard Graduate School of Business. And I say a lot of those things to kind of give all of our listeners a feel for the breadth and depth of your life's journey and what you bring to this story, the incredible amount of experience and your personal journey of how you got from where you were to where you are. And I don't want to be circumspect, but this has been a constant journey of evolution for you. Is that agreed?
Absolutely.
Ongoing. So before the break, we were talking about the very dangerous conceit that we do have about money's going to buy our way out of this. Human technologies are going to save us, liberate us from dependence on nature. We don't have to worry. We don't have to care. So go on about that, David.
Well, you know, one way to come into it is from the money side. It's really weird when you break it down. How will having more money solve anything if you recognize that money is nothing but an accounting entry? And, you know, if money is our biggest constraint to dealing with all these problems, you know, the Federal Reserve, as it has been demonstrating the last few years, clearly, it can create money with a computer keystroke instantly.
We'll just print more, and that'll solve all the problems.
Yeah, it can create trillions of dollars. There's absolutely no limit on the amount of money that the Fed can print. I mean, it will cause inflation at some point, but the whole system's rigged, so the inflation is all in the mainly in securities prices.
Right.
So, as you say, you know, you mentioned early in the show, we listen to the news, and you know, Wall Street's up or down today, and we're supposed to be all excited if it goes up. If you recognize that what that's really is how fast are the rich getting rich faster than the rest of us?
Yes.
What that's really.
What
saying.
Does their portfolio look like today?
Yeah, and you know, virtually all of the growth benefits. Benefits from growth, the financial benefits since the 2008 financial crash, have been going to the very richest people in the world. Almost all of it to the top 1%. And Oxfam just put out a report that says that calculates that now there's 62 billionaires in that. Now, that's just a small portion of the world's billionaires.
But right.
62 of the billionaires have as much wealth as, you know, calculated financially, as half of the world's population. And, you know, that gap is growing.
Yes.
And when we celebrate economic growth, that is basically, that's all going to a smaller and smaller number of the total population of billionaires, and you know, explain to me how is that going to solve our problems of inequality, exclusion, political corruption, and environmental destruction? And the obvious answer is that clearly it is not.
Clearly, it is not.
And it never will.
It never will. When kids in China are paying $1 million for a dog, Houston, we've got a problem. I mean, and that's
a story I hadn't heard.
No, that is an absolute true story. I watched an entire special on it, and then I Googled the heck out of it. Those kids, some of them, they have so much money that they have inflated the price of this type of dog, so they're paying $1 million, and then they're buying, and this is not, we do not digress, they're buying Cartier necklaces and collars and things to put on those dogs. And I thought, this is part of that story. I mean, your book really did get into my soul when you spoke at Bali in June. I went and I got the book, and I'm on my second reading. So that's why we have to have a second show, because we might have like a monthly series. You know, Tuesdays with Maurice will be Mondays with David. Because more people need to really hear the story about what's going on. Now, what about, so going on with this, you know, absolute ignoring nature, the widening gap, it's getting so much wider. What about the role that scientists play? Because the challenge for me with scientists is, it was the best story. I love the story about the six blind men and an elephant. Scientists have their culpability, not an intentional one, but scientists by and large, I'll make a stereotype here, they are so passionate about what they are studying. So there's the silo effect, the lack of integration of thought. So what would be a message for people that scientists need to start examining the whole elephant, not just looking at its tail? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And, of course, we need to connect that. It's not just science, but it's our whole organization of knowledge. And it is particularly deadly how it plays out in our educational systems and the breaking down of everything into siloed disciplines. So that, you know, we're not, well, our natural frame as human beings is to is to recognize, in traditional societies, indigenous societies, the interconnections of life and the interconnections of nature. But we actually have that all drummed out of us in a conventional educational system.
And that's a story for another show, David. You have to come back.
Yeah.
It's like, talk about building a story on a story that's false. There it is. Crystal.
There we go.
Yes, crystal clear on that one. Our broken educational system.
If you set about to design an educational system to destroy our capacity to see patterns, see larger patterns, and systemic relationships, it would be very hard to improve on the system we have.
You need to say that again, because it's like, let that land, everybody. All my listeners are chuckling. It's like, yeah. Okay.
And
go ahead.
Yeah. So it's a matter of rethinking the whole system of knowledge and rethinking our educational systems. Now, I think that's also beginning to change. Now, in some ways, there are elements of the educational system, and just listening to the stories about the corruption of the administrator that's running the Detroit school systems today.
Right.
They're
getting ratted out more and more.
Yeah, I mean we're beginning to see this, but we've got to have a radical revolution in education that takes it out of confinement behind four walls.
Sitting at desks when you're six
sitting
years old,
or sitting at computers, and having the whole thing dominated by a testing system. We got to get students out into community, into the world. But I think, much of my breakthrough and my understanding and my reaching out to really understand the story of how life organizes was, my connection to a very creative biologist, Dr. Maewon Ho, who lives in the UK, who introduced me to this concept, just this very simple story I told you about the cells in our body.
Right. Right.
How they organize, and there are biologies on the frontiers of what they call new biology, but it's creeping in into the larger discipline of understanding and trying to understand the extraordinary complexities of living systems and how they self-organize, but we've still got a long way to go, but my sense is that's opening up, and as I mentioned earlier, I think the same thing with our religious system. Now it's all partly relating to a growing confrontation with the extent to which our current systems are not working, and this, of course, includes the refugee crises that we're seeing playing out around the world.
Oh my goodness, so true.
That most people who I would hasten to say all people who find themselves in conditions of refugee status are not doing that by choice.
Right, so they can find. Oh my gosh, it's so true.
Yeah, I mean they are living in places where their economy absolutely has no place for them. Their environmental systems are crashing. The coherence of community and the outbreaks of violence as people
they're terrified.
They're terrified
on every level. I've got to get out of here and move my family and leave everything I've ever had to go and protect my family and save my life.
Yeah.
So that's the
story
of a refugee.
On the other side of that, you cannot solve that problem simply by absorbing all these people into the few places that are still
welcoming them, yes.
Welcoming them.
Allowing them to come in.
Yeah. We've got to get to the root of the crisis, the root of what is forcing these people to leave. And, of course, that takes us right back to our economic system
that
is ca- colonizing their economies and destroying their capacity to support their own citizens, just as it's destroying the capacity of the American economy to support our citizens, and the destruction of the environment, and of course the U.S. policies, war policies, and foreign policies that that are advancing the colonization, that are starting wars that that further feed the violence, and the arms industries that are arming these conflicts and profiting from them.
And it does
this is
go
the
back,
level at which we've got to address those issues.
And it does go back to your book, which is why, of all the books I've read, 10 years doing this show, what we need are living economies. That's what we need, and what we're doing is sending supplies way after the problem. And my husband and I, after being together in this journey, talk about it. You know, I love when you talk about how long you've been married to your wife, and you're really in favor of long marriages, and so are we, because you don't ever want to have to break a new one in or some in the most wonderful. It's like we're too comfortable. It's just, it's a wonderful thing to say. James and I have been married, it'll be 41 years, so it's like, yeah, this is really good. But anyway,
we're
into always
53 years, and we're finally sorting it out. So
there's new discoveries every day, and my kids are they're like, really, Mom? Really, Dad? You're still arguing about that? How long have you been married? So it's part of the joy. And I just, you know, to finish that thought, it's very important in terms of, I have no idea where to finish that thought, but what struck Lee Deep me about the book, and it is a segue to this, to the refugee crisis, to the blessed unrest that we're seeing all over this world, I believe, and it says it in the book, that we all experience the fullness of life through caring relationships of close friends and healthy, caring families and communities, and the great feelings that we all have when we help each other. This is not a kumbaya thing. This is a science-measured endorphins. What happens when you do that? What happens to others when you are in that state? It's science. So what I want to ask you is, doesn't a connection to nature have to be inextricably bound to that fullness of life and our essential happiness? If we destroy the earth, no matter how close we are to our families, I mean, it has to be incorporated as a conscious part of that. Obviously, I have a bias. What does David Corton have to say? It's like, connect to nature!
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that was one of the extraordinary parts of my earlier life experience, that I lived in a kind of semi grew up in a kind of semi rural location, and actually spent most of my summers or many of my summers as a youth up at Spirit Lake next to Mount St. Helens, which most of the world knows is
right.
The volcano that blew up.
Right, but there was a lot before and after that.
A lot before and after. I mean, it's anyhow, the part I experienced was the before, and it was just one of the most idyllic natural places on Earth. It was absolutely stunning. And I just, it was that connection with nature, and none of the understanding I bring to it now, but it just gave life depth and meaning and a sense of belonging.
And it's inherently, it's in your DNA as a part of that, your story. So it's you don't want to change that story. Same thing for me. My parents loved and adored nature, and they didn't tell us that. They didn't say, oh, we love and adore nature. You have to respect it. We went out in it.
Yeah.
And we built forts, and we took hikes, and we visited lakes, and we went on picnics, and we looked for deer. We're the only family I know that used to go on deer rides in upstate New York, so we could just go and see deer. I mean, it's like...
On deer rides?
Yes, we used to call them deer rides. And we used to beg my dad when we were on vacation, take us for a deer ride so that we could go and we would look for deer. We'd go for a two-hour ride to go out in the forest and be able to see deer. So that's part of my DNA. And, of course, my children have it and my grandchildren have it because we do it. you know, I don't want the story of this show to be over without me asking you a really important question for me as a person that is a global environmentalist that is committed to this journey and spreading story of changing our story, changing our future. One of the things that I worry about and that I want you to help guide us is how can we, with like minds, begin to organize better? There are so many groups, so many good causes, but the strength in numbers piece, it seems to elude us. I think it's going to have to be essential that in order to change our story and change our future, we have to somehow figure out, or do we? I mean, that's another one. Do we have to work harder in the direction of a more unified voice, or is it simply important that we have our story and find our voice for whatever story that is? I mean, I know you get the question. There's strength in numbers, and the market, the sacred market and money economy has a story. It's called earnings per share, return on investment, make more money, and probably be, you know, and be happier. That's what they tell us. So how do we organize? Even here in our city, we want to build we want to have building alliances for local living economies. But there's, you know, the Black Lives Matter. There's the people fighting for reform in prisons. There's the localists. It's a challenge, David.
It is absolutely a challenge, and you're absolutely right. We have to come together. It is one of the great failings of those of us who are concerned about the health of the natural environment, about issues of economic justice and so forth, that we get into the same silos that that science gets into. The corporate forces have been winning because they control the story. We tend to organize more around individual issues, but if you win the story war, you win the battle.
Yes, yes.
And that's why you know, the main focus of this book, Change the Story, Change the Future. But I also think that it's happening. You know, one of the things that is quite new is the emergence of the climate justice movement, which links environmental issues with social and racial justice issues.
Yes.
In a way that's
yes.
inseparable. And we see more and more leadership coming. I mean, one of the barriers that we've faced is the tendency toward identity politics, which one way of looking at it is a battle to remove the glass ceiling for a particular group, like women or people of color or whatever,
right.
That limits their ability to become equal opportunity oppressors in an oppressive system. Now, what we're beginning to see is from the excluded groups, people stepping forward to provide leadership for the whole.
Right. The Pope. We have to, like, hashtag the Pope. Because
yeah.
he is, seriously, because he's in the news and people are listening. And it seems like he has not polarized people around religion, but offered hope to all of us for what this means to have a socially just, to have a livable wage, to not make it be that we want more. So the Pope is another, when I get really down, I think, well, there's Pope Francis out there beating the bushes.
Yeah, no, he's, I find that the response to him is remarkable, that... you know, and it's part of an awakening that's happening within the faith community around a deeper story exploration.
Right.
But the you know the specific thing on identity politics, you know, I just see an amazing kind of emergence of this leadership of the whole coming from of course women. But also now communities of color around the climate justice that, you know, there has to be, you know, we have to organize as a global species that that recognizes the wonders of our diversity, but at the same time that we are, in the end, one people, in a sense, one tribe.
It's so true.
And that our, you know, we either make it together or we don't make it at all.
Right, right. And the kind of the joke that's on us is in intentionally or not ignoring the role of the very source that give us life, Mother Earth. She'll survive. And I want to say to people, you guys, seriously, you're the ones that are going to be dead, or your grandchildren are going to burn up, or there's not going to be any watered. Mother Earth will adapt because she will continue to give life. But it's like the joke is really on you. And I, you know, not really the joke, but it's like, come on, people, we're talking about the human component in this and how important it is to, you know, support Earth's capacity to support us. I mean, that's, it's, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
that,
yeah.
That puts it very, very starkly and very clearly.
Okay, we have 2 minutes left, which is really sad to me. It's like I didn't even get through the first half of the first page of my questions because...
Neither one of us is going to go away.
Neither one of us is going to go away, and I will keep bringing your book to meetings and saying, you guys, if we want to change the story, we have to change the conversation, and it's got to be based on a lot of the phrases in this book. So give us your last minute call to action. Do you have one thing for our listeners that can take away and that's really important for them to begin implementing in their lives, or something they can do if they care about this issue? One thing.
Well,
good luck
I
with
often,
that, David.
I often summarize it the way I did at the opening. It's advancing the awakening to the fact that we humans are living beings born of and nurtured by a living Earth, itself born of a living universe, and that changes everything.
And let that land with everyone. Let those words of wisdom land. When you talk, it calms me down. This energy I have in my soul to make a difference and wake people up. It's, you know, you, I'm sure you heard the tagline for my show: we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. Thinking human beings will get you, will get this story, we'll start looking at their stories. So it has been an honor and a privilege to have you with us for an hour, and we'll be knocking on your door to get you back. So tell Kat, a note to self, Gina's going to be calling, and we'll have you, David Court, in part two, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you so much.
To share these thoughts with your audience.
Everybody, take note. Change our story. Change our future. Our lives depend on it. Great show lineup for next week. Kevin Bonine's back from the Biosphere 2 from the University of Arizona. Great stuff to share. Next Saturday, Close the Fit Your Morals. Another Bali connection. Indigenous co-founders Scott Leonard and Matt Reynolds. Make it a great green week. Thanks, everybody.